Hello and welcome to Growing Up B2B. I'm Ed D'Elia, president of D'Elia Associates, the place where B2B brands go to grow. For over 60 years, and now across two generations, we've been helping B2B companies achieve next-level growth through brand distinction, quality lead generation, and sales enablement. Growing Up B2B was created for family business leaders who are passionate about growth, legacy, and making a lasting impact. Whether it's a multi-generational legacy or multiple family members working together, there's something truly magical about blending business with family. And we want to celebrate that right here on Growing Up B2B. So be sure to stick around to the end of the show and find out how you can be our next guest. Okay, let's get into it. Hello and welcome to another episode of Growing Up B2B. I'm your host, Ed D'Elia. I'm the second generation president of D'Elia Associates, the place where family B2B brands go to grow. Today, I'm joined by Patrick McGovern, president of Mack Boring & Parts. Patrick represents the fourth generation of leadership in a business that has now surpassed 100 years in operation. Founded in 1922 as a small machine shop, Mack Boring has evolved into a leading distributor and systems provider of diesel engines and electric propulsion solutions for marine and industrial markets across North America. Patrick has spent his entire career in the business, rising from sales to COO to president, navigating a complex leadership transition, significant family dynamics, and the ongoing challenge of modernizing a legacy company in a rapidly changing industry. Patrick, welcome to Growing Up B2B.
Thank you, Ed. Thank you. I appreciate you having me on the show.
Oh, it's great to have you today. So it's rare that we get a fourth gen on the show, so it's always exciting for us. So that's great that that you're here and that Mack is here still and going strong after now four generations. So let's start with the roots, though. If you look back across that amazing history, 100 plus years now, what do you think it is that has allowed Mack Boring to endure from generation to generation across now four?
Yeah, I guess that's a great starting point here. I mean, making our customers and partners a priority obviously is key. And when I go back to some of the early history, and obviously I didn't work with my great-grandfather. I actually didn't get a chance to work with my grandfather much at all either. He passed away in 1991 when I was still in high school. You know, so the first two generations, you know, it's a lot of stories that have been passed down. But the focus my great-grandfather had on building a business about a great customer experience, you know, it was clear in all the stories I've ever heard. You know, from what I've seen as well over the last, you know, 50 years I've been alive, I think the ownership, engagement, and passion is huge. And, you know, I think that's very common in family businesses. So, you know, maybe that's some of the pluses you get out of a family business to offset some of the complications that come alongside with that. And at the end of the day, just when we've had a big miss, you know, something was wrong, we made a bad decision. Really, it's been a lot of hard work and a lot of hard work and dedication to clean up any messes and making sure at the end of the day, our customers and partners know that, you know, we're here for them and, you know, we're here to do a great job.
Excellent. So a lot of people who speak to the patterns of multi-generation businesses, and I think in a previous conversation, we talked about this a little. So the first one is charged. They start it. The second generation builds it. The third sometimes runs into trouble or sometimes breaks it. And then oftentimes it's left to the fourth generation to prove it or reprove it again. You're obviously sitting in the G4 spot. So what do you think about that progression? Do you think that's true to form? And how do you feel about sitting in that the reproving ground spot as fourth gen?
Sure. Yeah. Look, I think in our case that repeated history has been you know, closer follow than maybe my father and uncle who made up the third generation would have cared to have signed up for, because they definitely, you know, they had some tough years. Mm-hmm. You know, you look back on it again. My great grandfather started the company in 1922. He was a machinist in the Navy during the First World War and came home and, you know, his family was from coal mining country in Pennsylvania. And, mm-hmm. you know, I kind of get the feeling, you know, that was a tough lifestyle and he wanted to go out on his own and and start something, which is what he did. And it started in his basement in Newark and built into, you know, our first shop in on Halsey Street in Newark in 1922. All the stories and the histories of my grandfather's involvement, you know, he was definitely the builder. You know, he brought in the engine distribution. My great grandfather had an outside partner for a period of time, and he made sure that, you know, there was no obstacles to growing the business, you know, within the family. And, you know, he found a way to buy out that partner, and really grow the company. And then the third generation, you know, they had a tough time, you know, and you know, both my father and my uncle, you know, they grew up, you know, we talk about it all the time in family businesses where, you know, business is mom, and, you know, that's the core of the family. And it couldn't have been more true in their case. You know, their mother passed away young when they were in high school, or my father was in high school and my uncle was still in elementary school. So, you know, my grandfather was very old fashioned and it was all work, work, work. And, you know, he wasn't looking to leave work to go to baseball games or, you know, do things outside of the work environment. So I think both my dad and my uncle had to use that connection with the company to stay close with their dad through all that. So, you know, and it, you know, they were both pushed, you know, your role is to be in the company. You know, my father attended 2 years at Villanova, and, you know, the message from his father was not, hey, go get a great education and bring that back to work. It was, you know, what are you doing goofing off at college? Get over here and get to work. So, you know, in hindsight, I think that education could have, you know, helped them a lot more, especially, you know, business gets more complicated as you go through. So, you know, what worked for my great grandfather and then my grandfather, you know, each generation, each level of growth you have as an organization, I think some of that education and that support is more important than what the previous generation would have needed. So, yeah, so, you know, they definitely had a tough time. And then, you know, when I look at my role in it, I think the best thing you could do is learn, you know, and, you know, make sure I use wisdom from past experiences and look at what's worked well and what hasn't worked well. And, you know, be fortunate enough to have seen that, that struggle and do everything in my power to make sure that, you know, we are able to handle the ups and downs a little more smoothly and not have as many of the fights that my dad and my uncle had to deal with through their years in the, at the helm.
Well, certainly, whereas the business may have bent a little in that third gen, it did not break. You know,
no, break. It didn't. We tested it a few times, but correct. And look, I think one of the other things too, just, you know, is hardwired into my way of looking at life. And, you know, I think it ties into, you know, who I am as a Christian and how I was brought up and just the world around us. Like, I think generally, you know, part of my role in this too is to leave it better than I found it. And my father did talk about that a lot, about being a steward of the company and, you know, making sure that, you know, he got it through the third generation and onto the fourth generation. But yeah, for one of my big focuses is wherever I leave it, whether it's going to a fifth generation, whether it's eventually sold, that's not really clearly laid out. But what is clear to me is making sure I'm leaving it in, you know, better condition than I found it. So,
yeah. And another recurring theme, and it's often interesting because I'll sometimes hear it from that G3 leader, who obviously has heard the same platitude that, hey, they're the ones that are supposedly the ones reportedly to most frequently screw it up, right? And the mantra is not on my watch.
You know? Yeah.
Not on my watch. I'm not going to let it go down on my watch. And I think, you know, even as a, you know, as a G2 myself, I felt that, you know.
Yeah.
I think we all feel that. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think, you know, I would describe that a lot more as pressure, you know, earlier in my career. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, that's a pressure and that's a, you know, it's out there and there's no escaping that. So,
yeah,
you know, that's definitely something multi-generation family businesses deal with, that for any advantage you have, that could certainly be a disadvantage too.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's certainly, you know, it's almost like a, and it's interesting that what you said, because I think I felt it more, more closely to the heart earlier on than later, because after a number of years you're like, well, okay, time and seems to indicate that I'm not going to screw this up.
Yeah.
If I haven't by now, I'm probably not gonna, because we would have run aground by now. No pun intended, knowing the industries sure. you're in.
Yeah, and look, I mean, obviously that came up a lot in the transition from the third and fourth generation, and maybe we'll talk about that more later. But you know, so you had that element of it is, you know, are we going to be able to figure this out together in a way that works for all of us in the future of the company? And then it also coincided closely with our 100th anniversary, which was in 2022. So, yeah, definitely want to at least get it to the 100th anniversary before I screwed it up. But thankfully, we got blew through that milestone, and you know, we're on a great track.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that, because my milestone was 50 years way back when, and now we're hitting I think we're at 62, but and my hard year was like probably year 51, because I spent my entire career thinking about 50. We got there, and I'm like, now what? So whereas most people had a good year, and in I guess it was 2015, we had a lukewarm year, because I really didn't have a vision past that, and that was my year to retool and rethink and refocus and all that good stuff. But it's funny what those milestones do. But they're important, and 100 is really phenomenal. So a lot of good things, you know, means more good things were done than not good across multiple generations. So that's great. Before we get into, you know, I am going to ask you a little bit about that succession from your dad and your uncle. But before that, you spent your entire career at Mac, but you started in sales. And I guess I was just wondering, is that the way that, you know, is that the way through the front door? Is like everybody starts in sales, or was that just where you landed? And talk about that experience and why that was, and maybe how that shaped, you know, where you would go from there.
Sure. Yeah. No. I think sales was my first managerial role, you know, role with, you know, real responsibility and a P&L, a budget. When I was first starting full time, my father, you know, wanted me in the parts department. So, and then taking a step back before that, you know, I joined Mac Warren, and you know, it was the start of my full time career right out of college. There was a lot before that that I think helped shape me as well. So, you know, even as a little kid, you know, I had an entrepreneurial spirit. You know, I was, my siblings will joke about, you know, remember when you used to swindle mom and dad's friends, selling them shishos at the shore? You just took a shell and put a little paint on it. I was like, yeah, well, it worked, you know. And you know, selling the seeds, you know, for the school fundraisers. I had paper routes growing up. You know, and they're little things, but they definitely give you some core foundations about business that never goes away. I mean, waking up as a eighth grader and having to get up at 5 a.m. Christmas morning because you have to deliver the papers. Like, wait a minute, it's Christmas. I don't work. It's like, yeah, no, that's what happens. having to collect from people, like my first paper out in, we were out in California at that point, you know, you had to collect, like they didn't pay you. You know, the only way you earned it was when going to people's doors and collecting your $2. It's like, better off dead. I want my $2. And that's such a real story for me. And, you know, you learn about people like, you know, these adults that would like give this, you know, heartbreaking story of how they can't afford to give you your $2 for your paper out. It's like, well, I didn't get paid for you, you know. So anyway, those are all cool experiences that come back. And I think also, you know, I spent a lot of time working around the company in high school and college as well. So, you know, my father and my uncle and that older generation, they were great about making sure I understood what was going on. And my dad used to joke, you know, like, you're not going to be an office pinky sitting at a desk, you know, you got to get out there and do a real job. So, you know, I got a chance to work in the service department, you know, our prep applications department, going out on the road with technicians, our delivery drivers. And you get to see a lot, you know, and experience a lot. And, you know, I don't think you can really be responsible for something you don't understand. You know, nobody's going to confuse me as a technician or an engineer, but I did work closely enough in those areas to understand what their day was like and you know, hear from them. And, you know, I was actually amazed back in those early days how much people would share with me that they would never tell my father, but they would tell me about, you know, all the good and bad things we did as an organization. So I had a pretty good foundation. And when I first started, you know, my dad was very set that, you know, the business runs through the parts department. You know, service gets our parts from there. Even when you do engine sales, production, you're dealing with your customers. And that was the initial plan. But it got changed quickly just because of, you know, circumstance, you know, and, you know, he had a very clear 2-year plan mapped out for that. And within the first 9 months, we were having a lot of issues. And next thing you know, I was actually working in the accounting department, helping to straighten that out. So, you know, we found a great CFO. I got myself removed from the accounting needs short term. And that's when the sales opportunity popped up. So a little quicker than the original plan, but yeah, it was a great learning experience as well, and a great time to have that opportunity because I was able to head up our powerboat sales division for the MR powerboat division back then, and that was a part of our business that was getting ready to explode. So it was a great fun opportunity, kind of cut my teeth in.
And it's not uncommon. In fact, I was just talking with a past guest recently where, you know, he ended up in an outlier division where he's working on straightening out some operational issues that they're having. And, you know, I kind of asked him, I was like, well, is that your background? He's like, well, no, it's more financial, but that's where I'm needed, you know? And I think, you know, if I can think of a common thread, it's like, there's the plan, but ultimately as the family member, as the next generation, you kind of plug the hole wherever the hole is. And you go sometimes where you're needed, even if it's, you know, you yourself are breaking new ground in your own learning and your own experience. But you do what needs to be done. And it sounds like that was a little bit of the case on your onboarding where you took a little bit of a detour, but then
absolutely
got back on track.
And even joining the company that quickly after college, it was never my intention or plan to jump in right away. But, you know, that was a period I mentioned earlier. My grandfather had passed away in 1991. Graduated in 97, and there was still a lot of family issues going on over the estate, and, you know, my father and my uncle were having a tough time there. So part of the reason of jumping in early too was a feeling of, you know, if I don't get in now and give my dad and uncle some help, you know, maybe there isn't going to be an opportunity in 10 years. So, you know, you have to adjust to the circumstance and do whatever it takes to help the company move forward.
So let's go back there for a moment. I just, cause that's interesting. And, often a common theme where, you know, the path into the family business is far from linear. you were set to potentially do something else. If you could, what were you thinking at the time?
You know, I didn't have a clear career path I was definitely committed to. I studied finance at Boston College. Pretty much everybody in that space was, you know, working either in Boston or New York City in a bank or some kind of investment financial, you know, role there. So, you know, that was a big commitment. I wasn't sure I was going to get into. You know, it was a different time. Like, I look at it now with my kids and, you know, the amount of time they spend, you know, charting their path forward and, you know, having, you know, trying to figure it out at a young age. You know, 96 was not a great time in the market for, you know, for college kids getting out, finding a new role. So I was a little unclear. And maybe that could have been another reason why I did end up coming in quicker than I expected. But like they say, you know, the rest is history. I was, you know, when I left school, I went out to California. I was living up in Lake Tahoe for 6 months. I was working at a Harrah's Casino Valet Park and looking around me. And, you know, I started to notice everybody up there either was there for like 1 or 2 years or they were there for life. as much as I enjoyed that, I, you know, it definitely wasn't going to be fulfilling for me to be up there for life. So, yeah, that's about the time when I came back in January of 97. So.
And not surprisingly, when you did come back, eventually you found your way to the accounting department because that was your training and that's where you were needed.
And that's exactly right. And, you know, it was funny, you know, early on, my uncle would, he was trying to protect me from that. He's like, oh, no, you don't need to go in there. That's, you know, you're too young for that. And, you know, I used to actually sneak in there. There was two ways to the accounting department. And there was one where I had to walk by his office and another one that, you know, came in through the back of the parts department. And, you know, I had to do that for a while just because, you know, I knew I had to get done. Yeah, it was a good experience as well. And, you know, I got that experience early on in that, you know, acting controller role. And working with banks and understanding, you know, the importance of not, you know, not telling your bank one thing and doing another. So again, all these lessons you learn early, and you know, it certainly has helped give me a stronger foundation as I moved into other roles throughout the company.
Yeah, for sure. You saw the numbers from the ground up, in a sense, and you know that gives you the clarity to know. You know, I've been looking at P&L since I was, I guess, 22 years old. You know, and you know, and I'm always baffled when I run into other people with larger businesses that are not quite as tuned in, and I wonder, okay, how are they doing it? Because I'd be not sleeping well at night if I didn't know.
Yeah, and what I love most about the finance major, you know, it was a lot of analysis and modeling, you know, and I think, you know, when you talk about it, you know, the ability to project out, you know, a 1 year, 3 year, 10 year budget, you know, forecast the impact of, you know, all the trade-offs you're doing and, you know, running a business and, you know, margin trade-offs versus, you know, the volume versus the higher retention there. You know, it was a great background to have. And in hindsight, you look at it, you know, in high school, if I was definitely gearing towards coming to work at Mack Boring, which I was far from, you know, clear with that back that far, everybody in this world, either, you know, you're either doing the engineering path or you're doing the business finance path. So it worked out well that I went that route. I think there's part times where I thought the engineering background could have been great as well. But I think as long as you have that foundation on one or the other, then you just support yourself with folks who are strong in the other area, and it works out well.
For sure. Yeah. And that's really, I think, you know, another recurring theme is a lot of our guests have a very good sense of themselves and what they're good at and what they're not good at. And that really translates to how they build their teams and what they look for in team members is basically to kind of people that can celebrate strengths that maybe they don't have, or they don't have quite as acute or quite as deep. So, but let's talk about a period that sounds like there was a little bit of, I'll just say turbulence. So it was around that time where you overlapped with your father and your uncle before taking over as president. So clearly there was, you know, a challenging time for the business. So if we could go back there, if I could take you back to that time frame, Patrick, what did that period, what were your takeaways from that period, both the good and the bad? What were some things that you carried forward there? Say, here's some things that I really liked about how they did things, and here's some things that, gosh, we really need to change to be effective in the years ahead.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, look, I'd say the first thing that they did that I always had great respect for, and they deserve a lot of credit of, is, you know, no matter how hard it got between the two of them and their relationship, they were very focused on, you know, coming back and making sure the business, you know, what was prioritized. And, you know, they knew, and, you know, going back to that, not on my watch, you know, there was a lot of grit and there was a lot of hard work and there was a lot of toughness there to make sure that no matter what, you know, the company's gonna succeed and move forward there. But I think the biggest things I learned watching that is, you know, a company needs strong leadership. And if there's a vacuum in leadership, you know, subcultures are going to pop up that could destroy companies. So that was the biggest thing that was, you know, really a huge challenge for us in that period is, you know, was my dad calling the shots? Was my uncle calling the shots? Was I calling the shots? My brother was involved back then. And, you know, our employees were getting mixed messages, and that was just really disastrous. So, you know, I had to learn about myself. You know, I also had to learn, you know, how to be a respected leader. You know, you don't get leadership without respect. Like, you can't be appointed a leader. You can be appointed authority. And you know, there's plenty of people who have authority, and you can make things happen with authority. But the best results, the best companies, you know, they're led by strong leaders who are respected, and they've earned that respect from the team. And you know, and that's not an easy thing to build.
So when we talked prior to this, you know, at one point you took on the president title, but in many respects, in terms of your day to day, you were more or less functioning as the president of the organization already.
Yeah,
I think that kind of underscores that, you know, the difference between leadership and authority. But what did, you know, talk about that. Like, eventually you said, all right, well, sure. I'm the president now, but you were kind of that for some time before. You know, you were playing that role, and then eventually you formalized it. But so if you could just kind of take us back to that little chapter.
Yeah, no, thank you. I mean, like, you know, a lot of that was a transition and, you know, going from my father's leadership with my uncle involved and then, you know, where I fell in that equation there. You know, and my father, my uncle, you know, my father early in his career, you know, he was a Marine, ran with, you know, he was a lead follow, get out of the way, you know, mentality guy. And that didn't always work out well with my uncle, who was, you know, 50% owner of the company. And, you know, I don't know if my father always wanted to, you know, or appreciate that, you know, he thought my grandfather should have left one of them in charge. And, you know, that led to friction, you know, and some, you know, some as expected conflict with him and my uncle. And, you know, so in 2000, probably around 2004, they became co-presidents. And, you know, they both had the title, they both worked together until 2008 when my father was getting ready to get out of, you know, day-to-day operations. So I think originally my father's, he thought that, you know, my uncle would agree and Steve and I would become co-presidents. You know, Steve had a different view at that point and kind of felt it was, you know, his turn to have that opportunity to lead the company. So he really insisted on being the sole president. And I was named, you know, chief operating officer. Mm-hmm. You know, my uncle is, you know, hardworking, passionate, you know, loved the company as much as anything in his life. You know, but there's just certain things on the management and leadership there that weren't in his wheelbox. And mm-hmm. And he didn't always necessarily want to admit that. So, you know, that's where I got in that position as the COO. You know, I reported to my uncle. Everybody else in the organization reported to me outside of his assistant. So, you know, I was basically working to pull that all together. But again, you know, it does create some, you know, mixed messages. You know, and I think there was times where if I'm pushing something and somebody didn't like it, they always had that back door to go to my uncle's like, hey, do we really need to, you know, work on this? And, you know, so it just created some inconsistencies and a little bit of dysfunction we didn't need. But, you know, when I was given, you know, earned the title of president in 2014, you know, that helped as well. But even then, it really didn't, you didn't see the results change and the culture change and the what we could do with the company change until 2017 when basically I finished a buyout of my uncle and he retired. Because even during all that time, you know, he and I had different views on a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was mixed messages being sent through the organization that, you know, that slowed us down.
Yeah. Yeah. So I do want to ask you about ultimately culminating the buyout. But before I get there, you raised such an important point, and it's come up several times on this program. And that's, you know, what happens when there's multiple family members in leadership and effectively too many chefs in the kitchen. And, you know, from all indications, you know, the look back is, yeah, that's just a recipe for disaster.
Certainly doesn't make anything easier, I can tell you that.
And ultimately, those companies that are family governed that do move forward, ultimately, they sort that out eventually. You know, sometimes it takes a little while, but once they sort it out, they say, wow, things are really running better now.
I'd be willing to put a lot of experience to back up that statement.
For sure. So effectively running the company, but ultimately assuming the title in around 2014, 2015, and then completing that buyout in 2017. So what did that moment feel like? Was it a feeling of relief? Was it sort of success? Was it finally? Was it or did it just kind of was it a moment in time that just happened that was already put in motion some time ago? How did that feel?
Yeah, you know, actually, relief is exactly the one word I would describe it as. You know, the initial feeling, but you know, a lot of mixed feelings. You know, because mm-hmm. you know, after there's 20 years really from when I started in '97 till 2017 till we got to that point. You know, there were a lot of, you know, hurt feelings and, you know, family struggles. You know, so yeah, it's definitely a mixed feeling from the family perspective versus the business perspective. But look, you know, I'm a big believer, and I think all good leaders are, that, you know, you have to have clarity as a leader and setting one message to the company for where we're going, how we plan to get there. and then not constantly giving mixed signals of, okay, unless you don't want to do it, or you, here's another alternative. You know, it's the only way to do something great. And I was very clear, and this is where a lot of the negotiation with my uncle came from, is like, look, I've been here 20 years. You know, at that point, I'm young 40s. You know, I was like, I'm at a decision point here. Like, I got to know that this is what I'm going to do the next 30 years, or I got to go do something else. And I'm not a ultimatum threatened guy. I didn't want to get in that position, but I did have to be very clear of like, look, you know, I love this company. I love what I'm doing, and I see so much potential here. I'd love to work to take it to that other level. But if I'm not able to, I can't do this. Yeah. And I think that's where we kind of got to at the end there. As much as he wanted to lead it, or he wanted to do it his way, you know, I don't think he really believed that he could. You know, it wasn't going to work well without me in there. And again, I didn't want to do it from a power play, but just more of like, you know, I wouldn't have ever been happy, and I wouldn't have done well in that situation. Yeah. I couldn't have done well in that situation. So that's where a lot of it kind of ended up.
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of, you know, guests on this show, myself included, have had that conversation. Hey, I love you. You're in family.
Yeah.
But one of us probably needs to go do something else soon.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because this is not sustainable.
Exactly. And, you know, and you know, those are hard conversations to have, right?
Like,
I didn't want to be disrespectful to my father or my uncle. And quite frankly, they didn't always make it easy for me to have those conversations. And, you know, they'd get a little nervous, or, you know, punch back, or, you know, maybe even a low blow here and while, like, hey, I'm, you know, easy there, Tiger. I know what I'm doing. But again, it comes down to like, you know, I wouldn't ever be happy or successful doing something, you know, that I didn't feel I could go out with my full heart and with, you know, to the best of my ability, or the rest of our team, you know. And that's the other aspect in this that, you know, you can't lose sight of as a family business, is like, if you want great people to work for you and you want a great team and you want to build a team, you know, they don't need the dysfunction. You know, they don't need that family dynamic. You know, they're going to go somewhere where, you know, they can be their best. So having that environment where people can do their best work it's essential for doing a good job.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I can't tell you how many times I've come across what I'll call, you know, an A player or A level talent who's moved on from a seemingly, you know, good position. Who's basically saying, you know, the infighting was too much. It just was too dysfunctional. I couldn't operate, you know, I couldn't be my best in that environment. So I had to find a new environment. And oftentimes it's a lot of that, too many chefs in the kitchen, or just, you know, too many moving parts from a leadership standpoint to really know who's in control. You know, what's the order of command? How do I get things done here? You know, how do I operate here and not lose, you know, lose my mind in the process, you know? So understandably so, you know, to get great talent, you have to have strong leadership and a solid organization, and it kind of makes sense. something else that I think you, a flavor that you brought in, and I'm not sure if the previous generation did this, but, and we touched on this in a previous conversation as well, was you built a board of advisors as well as, staying close to a peer network in the name of Vistage, a peer organization for CEOs. So talk about that for a moment. Why did you elect to build a board of advisors and get engaged with a peer group? What are some of those outside perspectives bringing to you as a family business leader?
I mean, it's been invaluable for me. And you know, you go back to what I was saying earlier, where my father was encouraged, you know, get to work right away, don't go to college, you know, and getting thrown right into this. And like, when you're in that family environment world and, you know, family business environment, you lose sight that like, there's so many other things you're struggling with. Every company struggles with, or, you know, many others do. So when I first started, actually, my father found Vistage first in 1997.
Okay.
And it changed him. It changed him as a man. It changed him as a leader for the better. And he, for the first time in his life, he had that peer group who could help him and give him advice and guide him that he never had before. I got involved shortly after. And, you know, I think in 1998, I started in a Vistage key group. You know, and I still have friends from that key group, who are in my close team advisors today. And then, in 2008 is when I was able to join a CE group. It was invaluable, you know, when you're starting. And, you know, even when I got that responsibility as COO and basically, you know, responsibility for all operations of the company, you think you're ready. And then it's like, okay, careful what you wish for. And it's like, wait a minute. All right. Wait, I can't go ask dad, or I can't, you know, like I got to know how to do this now, or I got to provide this leadership or this decision making. So having that group of peers who've been there, done that, you know, it's just, it helped me out so much. And you know, you're familiar with the Vistage program and, you know, the training, you know, and the speakers and the resources, you know, that just gave me so much of a continuing education that I needed. Going back to the fact that I jumped right into the family business out of college, and I didn't have that a lot of experience in other companies. You need that perspective of what other people are dealing with. And then I also need that perspective again when I was negotiating with my dad or my uncle, and you know what paths were possible going forward. And there was a lot of uncomfortable conversations I didn't want to have with the two of them. And, you know, those advisors held me accountable to have those and, you know, pointed out that if I don't, you know, things aren't going to end up in a workable situation there. So, you know, they've helped me get outside my comfort zone, which we all need to grow and learn. You know, they helped hold me accountable and then that's where it evolved into once I got through Vistage and using that team to help me through a really tough time from 2014 to 2017, where we just rolled it into, I left the Vistage organization as a, you know, from a membership, but I think four of my five board members were from my Vistage group, and we still work together today. So
that's awesome. That's awesome. And, you know, I think outside perspective can be invaluable, whether it be Vistage or YPO or EO or one of the other organizations. They're all, you know, deliver that that perspective that can be invaluable. And it's not in droves, but it's more in that one little thing you heard, you know, that sparked an idea that took something in a radically new direction that represented the difference between success and failure, you know. And I'm sure you've had a lot of those moments, and I certainly have too.
I mean, look, there's also a lot of talk about, you know, how much we're impacted by the quality and the type of people we surround ourselves with too, you know, and that's, you know, you want to be around smarter people than you, people who have had tougher challenges. And, you know, the quality of that group is, you know, it's just been, it's been a real gift for me.
Yeah. And I think a lot of the impetus for this program that some people don't fully realize if they're not from a family governed business is, you know, the first generation, there was no playbook. There was no, probably even a business plan. There was you know, hard work, tenacity, and a big idea and a dream, you know? So it was very much a progression of, I would liken it to, you know, were you to be building the battleship, but on the way to the war, you know?
And then,
eventually it's one of those next generations that are like, all right, how do we professionalize this? How do we operationalize this? How do we tech enable this? You know, how do we make this repeatable and drive that continuous improvement through the organization and, you know, make it something that is operational and scalable, you know, because, you know, a lot of that just simply wasn't, and I don't mean to make light of the courage it takes to be that first gen, to be the one that's willing to go out on the limb and shake it till it almost breaks and have that tenacity to stay with something, even when all the odds seem to be against you. But, you know, still it's, you know, still it's got to be cleaned up eventually. And that's great though. So speaking of, you know, the business and evolution, I mean, you know, it's almost staggering just to think about, you know, what Mack Boring was working on, you know, 100 years ago versus what you're working on today. I mean, probably almost irrecognizable if those folks were ever to come back through time and see what you're doing today. They'd be like, what is this? So you've gone from diesel into electric propulsion, lots of new tech. How do you decide, Patrick, how do you and your team make the call as to when it comes to some of the newer technologies, what to embrace versus where should we be cautious or where should we sit back and wait and watch?
You know, so our company does have a very innovative history. And, you know, I mean, my great grandfather, you know, he started the company as a machine shop and a service operation. But he, you know, he opened a diesel technical school. And, you know, according to some people, might have been one of the first or the first diesel vocational school in the nation. So he was ahead of his time with that. And then you look at my grandfather coming in. He was always trying new things, and you know, he was an incredible marketer. We have, you know, we've moved twice in the last 10 years. You know, the first move was a result of the buyout and, you know, unwinding the real estate from the operating mm-hmm. company. So we moved into a great building with had to lease it, you know, based on where I was individually. And but thankfully last year I had the opportunity to buy a new building. So we're in a new home, our third home in 8 years.
Okay.
One of the interesting things for moving is finding all the stuff that we held on to for over 100 years. So I always knew we had a lot of these old photos, but my grandfather, he was relentless in his marketing and his photography. So we have boxes and boxes of these billboards, you know, advertisements. He was always coming up with, you know, some promotional way of, like, you know, having Mack Boring stand out. But, you know, he started really our demo program for boating, which we still do to this day, where, you know, taking a new innovative marine engine and putting it in a boat. And, you know, the best way to prove it is to show it to people. Mm-hmm. So he was a big believer in the rotary engine in the 70s. We, you know, he had the Golden Wankel engine, and we actually have a cool display in our museum downstairs around all this. So we've always had this innovative, you know, mm-hmm. piece to us, you know, and, you know, we've always started with small brands that aren't known. You know, we're brand mm-hmm. builders. When Yamaha first came into this country in 1974, nobody knew what it was. Even when I first started in the 90s, people come into the boat shows, be like, oh, Yamaha, I have a Yamaha. It's like, no, it's Yanmar. Yeah. and now, you know, Yamaha has built their brand in the U.S. and they got their construction equipment and, you know, a much bigger global presence. But I guess, you know, in the more recent history, like, you know, we've tried a lot that works and we've tried a lot that didn't work. You know, and maybe the two more recent, you know, things that didn't work, we opened a motorcycle shop in 2010 called Mack Power Sports. We were an Indian motorcycle dealer. You know, in 2015, we got involved with Ox Diesel outboard engines and had a big investment in there. But both of those, we lost a lot of money in. Mm-hmm. You know, and you know, it was kind of a risky venture that I think is too risky for a distributor or a small company to take on. So, mm-hmm. You know, you look at some of the more recent things we've taken on. E-Propulsion is a great example of that. Those are, you know, E-Propulsion makes small electric outboards. It's a Chinese mm-hmm. company, Chinese brand. People didn't know of it here in the U.S. When we're looking at it, though, we're saying, okay, this is a smart way to try this electric space because they're small portable outboards. So if it doesn't work, you pick it up, you take it off and you put a 2-horsepower gasoline outboard on there. You know, there's not, you know, you're not designing a ship or a system and hundreds mm-hmm. of thousands of dollars, millions of dollars around a inboard diesel engine that's hard to reverse. So I think we've got a little smarter, and, you know, when we take on new things, having better agreements with the partners to where, like, mm-hmm. you know, if your product's good and it's going to be successful in our markets, the North American markets, we're going to get it there. But it, you know, I mean, most startups aren't going to tell you if they're struggling or they're desperate or, you know, so you have to be, you know, very selective in what you take on there. And, you know, we're just looking at ways to be able to do that with less risk to Mack Boring's brand reputation and pocketbook.
Do you think the marketplace, you know, has known you now across four generations? Would you say that, they see what you see in yourself, that innovative spirit? Is that would you say that you kind of have a bit of a notoriety there in that?
Yeah, you know, I think we could have more. You know, that goes back to our future branding and marketing. And one of the things I talked to our marketing department about now is, like, we talk about content now, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's content creation, video, podcasts, you know, mm-hmm. social media. It's all about getting a good story out there. We have a lot of old fashioned content that, you know, we have to fit, you know, digitize, you know, scan, get out there and, you know, mm-hmm. and help with that storytelling of all the different brands we've helped, you know, get a footprint in this mm-hmm. market. But I think we can always do a better job of promoting what we have done and can do for companies. But of course, you know, if we're negotiating with somebody for a new opportunity, we're certainly, Gotta drive that point home with them and show examples of what we've done for others.
Because if anything, that's a track record that really spans the entire gamut of the history, you know?
Yeah, it is. It is.
Yeah. So, you know, for any company that's looking, especially outside North America and is looking to break into this market and they're in your category, I think they'd want to have you on their list.
I would hope so. And I think confidently we could say we do feel we could do it better than somebody else, to launch a new brand in this market. It's not easy to do, but we have that experience and that persistence and tenacity. And I think we understand our markets so well that, we have a pretty good idea up front if something is going to make it or not. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's a hard, it's hard to pick, that racehorse who's going to win and who's going to come in second or third. I mean, it's hard in any industry, but across experience and seeing, what's worked and being candid about, hey, some things we tried didn't work, mm-hmm. know that too. You get better at picking the better horse this horse at least has a chance to be a front runner.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So got to touch on this because I understand now that the what would represent the fifth generation is starting to show some interest in the business. Talk about that for a moment. How are you, if you are even having those conversations yet, what are they looking like? And, how might you do it differently than maybe what your path was?
Yeah, obviously, we've had some tough, a lot of tough impact on the family life, mm-hmm. where the company came first and at a terrible expense to the family outside of that. So I have no interest in repeating that. Sure. I've got four kids, they're an amazing crew, I got a great wife, we're tight. And when I was growing up and when I was coming into the business, my father, I think, had a very different mindset. His focus and priority was, passing the business down to the next generation. And I really talked about this earlier, but, my parents were divorced. So we grew up with my mom in California. I wasn't your typical, fourth generation kid around the company all the time. We were on the other side of the country and there was a lot of, lessons from my mom of like, look, if you ever want to go work for your father, that's great, but don't make it where you need to or you're relying on that. Make sure you have your options. And that's where, mm-hmm. Getting myself into Boston College, getting my degree and just having that freedom of like, okay, I wanted to go to work there, but I didn't need to. Mm-hmm. So for me, it was an easy transition in, I got along well with my dad. I got along well with my uncle until we got into the tough negotiations at the end there. And I got along with my brother for the most part until, there became too much conflict and competition internally in the company. But it takes a special person to, work in a family business. It's more demanding. Every generation you go along, it's that much more complicated, and it's a harder thing to ask of the next generation to be able to run it well. Mm-hmm. So I say a lot. I'm open to the idea if the fifth generation runs a company, but it's not a goal. It's mm-hmm. certainly not a goal. And I don't have a plan, an exit plan. I'm 51 years old. I figure I got a good 15, 20 years before I'm moving on to the next thing. At least I'm enjoying what I'm doing. So we got some time to figure this out, but, mm-hmm. I'm not going to allow my kids, the next generation to have a situation where, it's not set up well, where, somehow the business, tears apart the personal side of family.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But to your point, I mean, I've had my my niece and my nephew, my oldest son have all worked summer internships here. Okay. My nephew actually just started full time with the company a month ago, so it's coming. It's something we're going to deal with. But I'm also been working to be more clear with the next generation of like this isn't some obligation, and this is this isn't some entitled opportunity you have here where it's definitely available. It has to be the right situation if that door is ever opened.
Yeah, that's great, because a lot of times there is definitely guests on our show that stepped in more out of duty and necessity than out of desire or passion. And sometimes those situations were dynamic, and you know, where somebody passed on suddenly, you know, and they had to. Sometimes it was for the good of the family, and sometimes you know, it was just you know, they felt it was their obligation. But it would seem that few and far between does it work out well if they felt it was duty bound versus desire bound, you know, and if they want it, then they're going to go for it, and it's going to go really well. So as you look to the future, just putting fifth gen aside for a moment, or really in the here and now, what are some things that are exciting you about the business or the industry, Patrick? What's some things coming up that are really exciting to you right now?
Yeah, look, I mean, we've been having fun, and we've been having our best years ever growing the company. So, you know, one of the challenges early on in my career with the company was over reliance and, you know, just one or two partners. We've grown the business well to where, you know, we have a great balance with our major product lines. You know, so, you know, between Yamaha, Scania, Zuzu, you know, there's a real nice balance there in business mix. E-propulsion is a fast growing, you know, segment of our business. You know, it's about 10-15% of our business are electric outboards. I wouldn't have guessed that, you know, just a few years back.
Yeah.
And then we also have, you know, we just got a great new opportunity with Mercury Marine last year, which is, you know, the preeminent name in the marine industry these days, and coming up with so many innovative new products. And, you know, in this world of all this tariff craziness, you know, it's a U.S. manufacturer. So that's great to have that in our portfolio as well. So, you know, we're getting a really good reputation, and we've been really enforcing the commitment we have to our customer experience and being able to attract the best partners in the industry. That also moves, you know, also equates into, you know, building a better team and having great, you know, employees in our organization. So, you know, we've had added a lot of great new team members the last couple of years. We'll all bring some new strengths, and, you know, having the best people representing the best lines and having a great commitment to customer experience, it's working out to be a real nice recipe for success for us.
Wonderful. And it sounds like you're having a lot of fun along the way, which is great to see.
We are. Yeah, I am. And I think the whole team is. So.
Wonderful. Last question. If anyone wanted to connect with you to learn more about your journey, or to connect with Mack Boring to learn more about what the company does and is all about, what's the best way for them to connect?
I mean, look, we work to put ourselves out there as much as possible. So, we have a large following on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, LinkedIn, both personally and for the Mack Boring pages there. So I'd say those are great. You know, we're very active at trade shows. You know, you'll see a Mack Boring representation at almost every single boat show or industrial show in the Northeast, and even nationally for a lot of those as well. You know, our team is out. We've got a big sales force out calling on dealers and OEMs. You know, interesting though, think about this answer. Like, personally, you know, one of the things I do to make sure I am always giving back to customers and partners, you know, I do ignore a lot of unsolicited emails and voicemails. So, you know, advice my father had said, you know, when I do, when I'm trying to connect with somebody for the first time, it's like, write a letter. Nobody writes a letter anymore. And I can guarantee anybody who takes the time to write a letter, it's going to get read. I check the mail every day. Or, you know, just reach out through one of the other channels and put some kind of personalized note in there. So.
Awesome. Great. Well, to wrap up, Patrick, what really stands out in your story is longevity in a family business, especially four gens, is not accidental. It requires resilience, adaptability, and the willingness to navigate both business challenges as well as the personal dynamics that come along the way, with discipline and perspective and really a balanced emotional state. So Patrick, we thank you for sharing your journey and your leadership story at Mack Boring into its next century. And again, for our listeners, we've been speaking with Patrick McGovern, president of Mack Boring and Parts, and I'm your host, Ed D'Elia. And this has been another episode of Growing Up B2B. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time. Patrick, thank you so much for being with us today. This was great.
Thank you, Ed. That was a great honor. Appreciate it.
All right. Hey, thanks so much for tuning into Growing Up B2B. To explore more episodes and insights, visit podcast.deleonet.com. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please give us a rating or review on your podcast platform of choice. Having worked with hundreds of family-led businesses across my career, and being a second-generation leader myself, I'm on a mission to help every family business I meet achieve next level growth for their organization. So feel free also to connect with me on LinkedIn and let's support each other. You can also find out more about my company at DeliaNet.com. Again, I'm your host, Ed Delia, and thanks so much for joining us today. Take care.